I think it's really important when you consider the changes to wheat to look at the history of wheat breeding. It's very interesting because I've come across a feature on John Bingham. And in my last post, I interviewed him. And I think one of the things that we tend to do as bakers is really slam modern bread, the Chorleywood bread making process. Artisan bakers tend to talk about it as though it's the absolute epitome of evil. And the truth is that that process has huge problems, not least that the bread, in my opinion, is flavourless. It's pappy, it's white, it's made with industrialised flour that has had most of the good stuff removed from it. It also is made really quickly, which means that the proteins don't break down. So anybody who has got difficulties or problems with their digestive system stands a much greater chance of developing an intolerance, because in simple terms, if you have a compromised human gut microbiome and you've got difficulties, then you can get a permeable gut wall, which leads to the proteins getting through, and that means that your immune system will effectively go on red alert and attack the proteins. Ironically, it's the proteins of things that you eat most often that you develop intolerances to. It's a complex area, but the simple truth is that long, slow fermented bread is much, much better for you. Going back to that thought process about the Chorleywood bread making process being the epitome of evil, that isn't what happened at the time. And I think that it's important to look at the bread making in the context of what was going on historically at that point in time. I think if you look back, you'll see that British wheat was not really considered to have a high enough kind of souffle point, if you like. And John Bingham, who was the head of wheat research at the Plant Breeding Institute, which is now NIAB, and a colleague of his, John Blackman, were there kind of as breeders, looking at the process and trying to develop wheat breeds that would suit a process that was designed to feed the world. It was designed because people didn't want to go short of food again. So as British wheat was not suitable for fluffy white bread, and it was North American wheats that were really kind of coming forward in this process, John Bingham and his team of scientists had to try and achieve what was a scientific breakthrough to develop a British wheat that meant that the bread makers didn't have to keep importing. If you look back at the time, the average per acre in Britain was 2 tonnes or 2.35 tonnes. And the quote here is, you can't do that with muck and magic. You've got to use artificial fertilisers to get high yields. I think they regarded bread making as simply a physical process, and it was all really dependent on the protein and the makeup of that protein. So what they did was they set out to breed a variety and marry up the genes to get the best variety. And they looked at various breeds, including one called Browick and Red Fife. And they went on to produce various breeds that suited industrial bread making process. It was actually in 1968 that John Bingham and his team, which were six people, did over 200 crosses, and they used a special one with genes, and it's here called RHT2, which produces short straw. And they planted over 2,000 of each to produce about 500,000 seeds in all. Their target was to produce a wheat which had high quality protein, really strong, resilient against pests and disease, and it was good for lodging. Lodging means that it has short straw so it doesn't get thrown down flat when there's a wind or a storm, so it's difficult to harvest. It needed to ripen early. I think that we had very challenging weather conditions, we still do in the summer. So they wanted to make it attractive to farmers and at the same time have a high yield. And they designed a wheat that was responsive to fertiliser, large doses of fertiliser. It was the perfect wheat for modern agriculture. They were specifically looking as well for specimens that were resistant to things like brown rust, mildew, yellow rust, and something called eye spot. And it took weeks and weeks to check them. They were checking when they ripened. They were pulling them up by the roots, checking them, threshing them. And the young plants were actually then treated with disease spores and examined and watched to see how resistant they were. There were 3,000 of them that they chose and replanted. And then about 8 years after this began, the grain went to the Chorleywood bread making plant over in Hertfordshire, where it started being tested for its bread making quality, the protein content, the texture of the flour, and how easy it was to mill against the weights and the falling Hagberg number. They were looking for how the alpha amylase, which is the enzyme, was stable, and if it would give it a crumb that wasn't too sticky. I think it's important to realise here that the enzymes, if there's a particularly wet harvest, become quite active in British grain. Enzymes respond to the weather. And they really developed a grain called Bounty, which has a high falling number. It passed all the tests effectively with flying colours. And it was had a shorter straw, it ripened earlier, and it was resilient against all those diseases. And the farmers were convinced this was the missing piece in the puzzle of the Chorleywood bread making process, if you like. It's quite important to realise here that the government's Agriculture and Development Advisory Service and the chemical companies were all on hand to prompt what we would now see as being the right decisions. And farmers were then encouraged to adopt intensive growing techniques, to put a programme in of fertilising, to use herbicides for weed prevention. And they were being shown incredible results. You have to remember, going back to the beginning of this of me talking here, that the national average of food production per acre at this point was about 2.3 tons per acre, and using this system, using these chemicals and bits and pieces, they rocked it out to almost double, 4.5 tons an acre. And the cost against the per acre was really giving farmers a higher income. They started spraying with herbicides, which were designed to kill broadleaf grasses before they came up. They had big boosts of fertiliser, looking almost at putting over 200 pounds of nitrates per acre. The weeds were then tackled using a spray called Britox, which again was in the spring tackling things like thistles and poppies. And then, really importantly, they sprayed again in the spring in about April time with a heavy boost of nitrogen fertilizer. Again, they were spraying with... In fact, some of these sprays now have now been banned, but they were spraying again after that initial boost. And the corn came up and there was a big application of nitrogen. And I think that it's really important to realise that it's at this point of the high nitrogen that there is a change in the gluten and the gliadin structure. And this is the point where the ears are forming, where you have this nitrogen that literally boosts the gliadin. And it's the gliadin that makes your bread stretchy and kind of really allows us as bakers to make those really high rising loaves. It gives it its danceability. But it was a massive change in the structure of gluten. And it is literally on a graph, runs in absolute parallel with the amount of nitrogen that is on there. It's also gliadin that is the protein that celiacs have a problem with. Now, I'm not suggesting that this is cause and effect, because celiacs, of course, it's a genetic predisposition. But in terms of the development of these modern agricultural processes and these modern wheats, this was where it became apparent that we were changing the structure of gluten with new breeding and new agricultural systems using chemicals. It's also important to realise at this point as well that it was in the sort of late spring that the spray came in with the fungicides, which was also an insecticide, was also included, that killed all the bugs. The ladybirds would then suffer. So it's quite a change to go from the traditional method of farming to this intensive production using these new breeds that were effectively designed for the Chorleywood bread making process. So it meant more chemicals on the land. Frankly, it's on record here that John and his team say that we don't believe that the tests are being conducted continually on chemicals. We don't believe these things to be harmful to humans. He said, if you want to eat bread, you have to use them, and you can't get to production without them. I think it's really interesting now that we know full well that some of these chemicals, for example, glyphosate, Roundup is now universally acknowledged and understood to be a carcinogenic. But if you go back and listen to that interview from my last post on Audiobee, listen to John and the way he speaks and what he was saying, they were people who really believed that they were at the cutting edge of development, that they were creating their own revolution, that these chemicals and these processes were designed to make bouncier bread, to feed more people cheaply. It was about national security. It was about being able to feed the whole country with bread. And so I don't think that for one moment any of them considered themselves to be creating this industrial process that ultimately I think and I believe is, for me, is as dangerous to long term as perhaps smoking or something like that. I think that this fast fermented, nutritionally devoid white pappy white bread is responsible for the baseline health of most people, especially people who can't afford anything else, or don't know about anything else. Anyway, they're my thoughts. I just wanted to kind of run through that, really, as much for my sake as anyone, to put a kind of I guess a full picture of what wheat breeding meant and the fact that they worked with the Chorleywood bread making process, and we're still making our bread with these with these breeds today, or with breeds that certainly came off of this initial development.